My name's Sermon Addict. Is that working? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, and I'm well scared sitting here, I have to say that. When I was asked to do this show, it was about 2 days ago, and my first thought was no. And then I remembered that one of the things I've learned in recovery is that unless I've got a really good excuse, you know, service helps keep us clean. And I didn't have a really good excuse. And I also had to remember that my first response to anything, or my first reaction to anything, is I can't do it. And that goes for anything. And so I picked up the phone, or rather I text, and I said, yes, I'd do this chair. And for the last 48 hours since I said that, yes, I've been doing this chair in my head. And you know, it's been the most positive self-talk I've had for a long time. So thanks. Thanks for asking me, Sam. Thanks. Thanks, Roz. Because, you know, left to my own devices, I don't have positive self-talk. I've got a lot of negative self-talk. And that's to me what this feels weird, sort of. The other thing that's happening to me recently is I think I'm turning into a man, you know. I've sort of spent years saying, I don't get very angry. I really don't get angry. I save my anger for the privacy of my own home. I only get angry with my husband, my sons, and occasionally my cat. Anyone else sort of outside the house, I don't, you know, I'm very nice, very quiet, very self-effacing. None of anyone out there would know what a mad harridan I can become indoors if the slightest thing crosses my path. You know, if I get up in the mornings and, I don't know, someone hasn't cleaned the bath no, that's not true. Most mornings I get up and someone hasn't cleaned the bath. But, you know, some mornings my husband can sort of look at me in the wrong way or not respond in an appropriate manner, and that's a manner that I think is appropriate. And suddenly I find myself coming out with this stream of vitriolic abuse that I wouldn't, you know, if anyone even suspected that I knew those words, I would actually die of shame, you know. But lately, I don't know what's been happening to me lately, but I think I'm turning into a man because, you know, I've sat in these meetings for years and I've heard mostly guys talk about the anger of being out on the street or driving, but say walking down the street, and I've experienced this with the men in my own family, sort of walking down the street and someone will come a bit near them, come into their space, or look at them the wrong way, or I don't know, be wearing the wrong clothes or something, and that rage will come up, that red mist. And it started happening to me recently, and I found myself on the tube this morning. I got to my tube station and the metro wasn't there, because the station's just been refurbished, and the sort of holder that has the metro. Does everyone know what the metro is? That sort of free newspaper. And I've got a long journey to work, and the idea of sitting on the train or standing on the train without something to read, and I'm also studying, and I've got loads to read in work, so I can't read any of that stuff, so I have to read the metro each day. And fuck, it's not been there. It's not been so that right away, you know, I got to the tube station, and there was no metro, so I had nothing to read. I got on the tube and there wasn't a seat and I had to stand up. And not only that, but what went even worse, there was a seat actually. As I got on, there was a seat, but some fucking bastard got on the train before me and took the seat. And you know, this some fucking man got on this train before me and took the seat. Now the thing is, I found myself thinking, he should have given me that seat because I'm a woman. And yet, you know, I've been on the train and some poor guy has gone to stand up for me and say, would you like a seat? Are you saying I'm fat? Are you saying I'm old? He must be thinking I'm fat because he thinks I'm pregnant because he's given me a seat, you know. Or is he saying I'm old? So, but, you know, so this guy couldn't have won. But anyway, he had a seat. He was fine. He had a seat. And there was a woman sitting behind me. The guy was there. The woman was there. And behind the woman was a copy of the Metro. And I thought, well, great, a result. At least I've got something to read as I'm standing there. And I reached over this woman. And I'm sure I said, excuse me. If not, it was really obvious what I was going to do was to reach behind her and pick up this Metro. And she flinched. She sort of flinched and rolled her eyes like I was going to hit her in the face or something. I thought, fuck. And then I really did want to hit her in the face. You know, and that's how I found myself this morning. And it's funny, and it's, you know, but it's not. It's really painful. What I've done this journey on the tube for a long time in recovery. And, you know, things happen. There were the terrible things that happened last July in London, and, you know, trains crash, people get killed. And I can remember thinking in early recovery, when I was about 3 years clean, I was on the tube making this journey. And I found myself being really irritable and, you know, hating everyone around me. And I remember thinking then and making a conscious decision that I wasn't going to travel in that frame of mind. Because anything could happen. And, you know, if that train was to crash and that was my last moment on this planet, I do not want my last moment on this planet to be surrounded by people that I think that I can't, that I don't want to be around. So I've made a conscious effort since that time to be at peace with my surroundings, and that includes on the tube in the morning. And that takes, you know, that takes a lot of maintenance. And you know, something's been happening recently. I've got an idea what's been happening recently. I've had a lot of changes in my life. I've neglected to do the things, the daily maintenance things, that I've learned work in recovery. I've been in recovery a long time. I was 18 years clean in June. And thank you. And I say that not because I think that it is important. It's extremely important to me that I'm 18 years clean. But I'm also aware that when I first came around, when I first came to meetings, I had two responses to somebody who, you know, had a lot of clean time. One was, that's absolutely amazing that they can do that. And the other was, but that's absolutely meaningless. Why does that person still need to be coming to meetings? And when I first came to meetings, you know, it was a real struggle. It took me 18 months to actually get a day clean. And during that time, the people I looked up to were the people who had a day clean, the people who had 2 days clean, the people who had a week clean, because that was what meant something to me. And hearing people with X number of years clean didn't really do it in the same way. And I don't know if it's like that for anyone here. But it took me 18 months of coming to meetings. I didn't know anyone who was in recovery. I used for a long time. I've actually been in recovery now for longer than I used. I dabbled for a few years, but I didn't actually have, my addiction didn't really take hold until I was 20. And then I used for the next 15 years on a daily basis. And, you know, when I first picked up my drug of choice, I thought that all my problems were solved. I really did, because, you know, we talk about the disease of addiction. I don't know if I was born an addict. I really, you know, I know I was born into a family where there was chronic shame and chronic low self-worth. There was nothing in my family that anyone felt proud of. To me, growing up, it was... For me, growing up, there was a sense of shame about everything in my family. I didn't know who my father was. I was brought up by my grandparents. And that in itself was a huge source of shame for me. But in my family, there were secrets about everything. There were lots of, there were secrets about things that there was no need for things to be secrets about. You know, the fact that my grandfather was Jewish, that his family had come to this country in the early sort of 1900s, all that was a secret. Lots of these things I found out as I was growing up because they'd all been kept as secrets in the family. So I grew up with this terrible sense of shame that there was something wrong with us. We weren't good enough. And it wasn't even a suspicion that we weren't good enough. I just knew that my family wasn't good enough, that I wasn't good enough, that there was something intrinsically wrong with me. By the time I picked up my drug of choice, that sense of disease, that sense of things not being, of me not being good enough, was so painful. It stopped me, it stopped me making friends. It stopped me, if I did make friends, it meant that I couldn't take anyone home. I was really embarrassed about anyone coming to my house. I didn't know how to behave. You know, when I first started secondary school, I went to there were grammar schools in those days, and I somehow, I'm saying that now, that I somehow passed my 11 plus and went to grammar school. That's the shame, the low self-worth, that I couldn't accept that I was a bright girl, that I was intelligent, that I was attractive, that I actually had, a lot of strengths, a lot of assets. Because, I was so damaged by this disease. And, I went to this school and it was away from the area where I'd grown up. And nobody from where I lived actually went to grammar school. Everyone went to the local secondary modern school. And I went to this grammar school with girls who all seemed really posh. And within the first week, I'd suddenly set this record of having 4 detentions in 2 days and got into trouble day after day. And I didn't know why. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to be appropriate. I didn't know what sort of behavior was acceptable. And from that time on, I learnt. What was confirmed to me at that time was that it wasn't okay to be me. So when I first picked up my drug of choice, suddenly I felt okay. I felt okay for the first time. I felt comfortable in my body. I didn't feel too big, too strange looking, too loud. I always thought I was too big, too loud, just too wrong. And when I picked up my drug of choice, I suddenly felt okay and that I fitted in. As everyone knows, that sort of state doesn't last very long, and pretty soon that addiction brings other problems with it. For me, it took another 15 years after that before I actually got clean, and during that time, my life had got more and more complicated. I mean, that's the other thing. As an addict, I had... As an addict, I had the propensity to really complicate my life. I wasn't happy, I felt uncomfortable with myself, I'd come from this place of not knowing who I was, how to be in the world, discovered taking drugs made me feel better. So then I decided to get into a relationship, to get married to another using addict, and to have 2 kids, and then to move hundreds of miles away from my support network. And then wonder why things got really difficult. Because, you know, today I work with pregnant women drug users, and that is such a painful place to be. That is such, you know, I've got a lot of compassion today for anyone in active addiction, but particularly when I see these women who are not going to get it. You know, who really not in the same way that I didn't get it, and, you know, went through two pregnancies and my children, these babies born, suffering from the effects of my drug use. My second son nearly died. And I didn't get it. I knew that I was damaging my children, and I knew that I wanted to stop, but I couldn't stop. I didn't know how. And I see that on a daily basis with the women I work with today. And I mean, that is just sad, because I know there's a solution. And I can, you know, and I can tell people about this, but at the end of the day, we have to get this for ourselves. And I don't know what happens. I don't know. You know, that to me is the miracle of recovery, when someone changes. When I changed from, because I went to my first meeting in 1982. Somebody told me about this fellowship. And at that time, I was desperate. I had two babies. I'd vowed when each one was born that I was going to stop using. I had a one-year-old and a two-year-old. I, you know, couldn't stop using. Didn't know how to get clean. Didn't know anyone who got clean. And someone told me about this fellowship. And I went along to a meeting, and I didn't get it. It took me another six or seven years to get it, because I went along to that meeting, and I just wasn't ready. I looked around, and I saw these people who looked well, were well-dressed, healthy, clean, and I thought they were lying. I didn't believe them when they said, you know, we were like you not very long ago. If you do this, this, and this, it'll work for you. I just didn't believe it at all. It took me another 6 years before I was 12-step by somebody I'd used with, who came round to my house. I hadn't seen her for a while, and she said that she'd been going to meetings. And when she told me what these meetings were, I was like, yeah. But something had changed, because I became willing. I think 6 years had passed, and you know, the actual, it's not even the degradation or the horror. You know, I've heard some horrendous stories since I've been in recovery. I don't really have a horrendous story. You know, lots of, you know, I came into recovery with my family intact. I hadn't been in prison. You know, I've got the usual viruses, scars, emotional, spiritual, and physical that a lot of us have. But, you know, I came into recovery more or less intact. My children still with me. I hadn't been in prison. You know, I had all my limbs. But spiritually, I wasn't. I had nothing in the bank. You know, I just wasn't present. I went right back to that young teenager who felt like she wasn't good enough, that there was something wrong, that there were terrible secrets. Only by this time, you know, I was a woman in my 30s who really did have terrible secrets, because I'd have to get up each day and go out into the world and try and cover up and pretend that I was a normal person who could get on with my life, and nobody knew the things I had to do to keep my habit going on a daily basis. And I've just lost what I was saying, which, so I didn't have that horrific rock bottom that I've heard some people talk about, but I had this daily misery this daily sense of not feeling human. You know, I'd look at people in the street and I'd think, well, how can they just get up and go about their lives without taking something? I really believed I had some sort of chemical imbalance that just needed the right sort of fixing each day. And I couldn't understand why no doctors or authorities accepted this and just gave me what I needed each day. So it wasn't this horrendous rock bottom. It was more of a daily, slow, drizzly death. And I was miserable. I was miserable. My children were miserable. And that was, you know, that was one of the... I'd like to say I got into recovery for my children, but actually, that's not true. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't... The same reason I couldn't stop using when I was pregnant, I couldn't get into recovery for my children. I only got into recovery by coming to meetings, by getting the willingness. Let's say I came to this meeting in 1986 and something had changed because I actually heard something that made sense. I heard the guy who was doing the chair talking about how it had been for him and how his life was today. And I don't know how it worked, but it did. I got some hope. And as I say, it went on. It took me another 18 months because whilst it gave me hope, it still didn't give me the ability to be able to put down the drugs. But I came to enough meetings. How are we doing? How... Oh, 20 minutes. Have I only been...
Yeah.
But then I'll have to sit like this. So when I first started coming to those meetings, and I'm talking about those meetings because meetings have changed a lot in the last 18 years. There's a lot more meetings than there were 18 years ago. And the first meeting I ever went to was a meeting in Swiss Cottage on a Sunday evening. And that was the meeting I went to, and I really got hope. And at the end of that meeting, a guy came up to me at the end of the meeting and said to me, "Do you think you've got a problem with drugs?" And I thought, ha, I've fooled him. I obviously look like someone who shouldn't be here. He must think I'm a social worker or somebody who's just come to find out. I don't know. He thinks I'm a social worker who's come to the meeting because he had to ask, "Do you think you've got a problem with drugs?" And I wasn't sure. I knew my life was miserable. I knew I had to use drugs on a daily basis. But I still didn't know I had a problem with drugs. That chair I'd heard, the chair that I'd heard, that guy really had a problem with drugs. He'd been in prison. He'd been in hospital. He'd done things that I'd never done. So he really had a problem with drugs, and therefore this program worked for him. But I wasn't entirely sure that it would work for me. And that's probably why I went away for another 18 months. But I didn't entirely let go. I still kept linked in to this woman, to this friend who was going to meetings, and once every couple of months, and then once a month, and then once a week, I went to meetings, and during that time, I got onto a methadone script, and this time, I didn't get thrown off the methadone script, because, you know, in those days, what happened, you know, you'd go along to the DDU, and you'd get a methadone script, and it'd be like this reducing thing. There was no luxury. This was before HIV. HIV just sort of started then, so... back in those days, we never had it so good, you know. You really had to fight to get a methadone script. You couldn't buy needles and I want to start doing one of those, you know, one of those stories about how bad it got. And actually, sort of thinking about that now, I can feel my sort of male rage coming up again, and thinking, you know, we couldn't buy needles. We didn't have needle exchanges. Not like nowadays, or not like the last sort of 10, 15 years when addicts, you people, have had it really soft. You know, you want a methadone script, you go and get it. You get, you know, people can even get heroin scripts nowadays. Well, let me tell you, it wasn't like that in my day. You know, 10 of us had to share one needle for 6 months. Scraping it on a matchbox, sharpening it on a matchbox. And you know, that's actually not very funny, that's actually really sad. And a lot of people died. But after going to that meeting and getting that hope, I was able to go along and get another methadone script. And this time I didn't use on top of my script. I managed to do, and this is a real miracle, that I managed to do that reduction. I managed to go along, get this script, and use nothing else, have the regular urine tests, go, and I started seeing a counsellor at this DDU. Something had changed. It had gone from this place where the workers were just out to catch me, to trip me up, to find out that I was using, to humiliate me, to shame me, to take my kids off me. Things changed, and it went to a place where there were people who were human beings who were there to help me. And I know that miracle happened because I'd come to these rooms and I saw something different. You know, before, because I'd grown up in this place of shame, this place of don't let anyone know. I mean, that was a big thing that, you know, growing up in Liverpool where I did, a big thing was don't let them know your business. It was like, who are you looking at? You know, and you know, that was the biggest thing. Who are you looking at? Don't look at me. Don't see who I am. And this is the thing that's really changed for me in recovery. To be able to show up. To be able to be seen. Because I grew up thinking it wasn't okay to be me. And I was told, I got evidence. Wherever I looked, there was evidence. No, it's not okay to be you. Whether it was from my family, because I got evidence from my family on a daily basis. Keep quiet. You know, you're too big, you're too loud, you're doing it wrong. Because I didn't get any affirmation. I didn't get told, oh, you know, that was really good, that was well done. No one said well done in my family. In recovery, I think, you know, in recovery, we learn to say, well done. We learn to affirm ourselves. We certainly learn to affirm our children and those around us. But that never happened to me growing up because my family was so riddled with shame. They felt so less than. That they were ashamed of the sort of things that, you know, the things that nowadays, the things that anyone's sort of proud of, like, you know, one of the really nice things I think now is that when little girls first start their periods, people have parties. Sort of, you know, I just think that's so amazing. Because when I was, you know, 11 years of age and started my periods, it was like the horror of this happening to me and if someone were to find out and this terrible shame. And, you know, my grandmother agreeing with that, well, look, this is what we do and don't let anyone know. Don't mention it to anyone because, you know, if anyone knows you've started your period, then they'll make fun of you. And it was like, you know, perfectly normal thing like that. And, you know, passing my 11 plus, I can't remember anyone actually saying, well done. What I can remember was that sense of shame that, oh, you know, you can't walk down the street wearing your school uniform because people will call you a college pudding. What, you know? Or, or my, I had an adopted sort of sister. I say sort of sister because my grand, you know, this is how fucked up my family were and the sort of shame. And I was brought up by my grandparents because my mother was a teenager when I was born. My dad was an American who'd gone back to the States. And so my grandparents pretended that I was their child. But they'd also adopted another child who was 4 months older than me. So suddenly they had these two babies who they pretended were twins. Now, we looked nothing like each other. And there were 4 months between us. Now, I didn't know, when I was a little child, I didn't know the ridicule that that would elicit if I went around saying to anyone, you know, we're twins, and she's 4 months older than me. You know, and on a daily basis, I'd set myself up in that way. And, you know, I had... So where I live, sort of on this real sort of working class housing estate in Liverpool, it wasn't okay not to have a father. And I didn't even know I didn't have a father because I thought my granddad was my father. And, you know, then I'd have the local kids sort of calling me a bastard and saying things about me not having a dad. And I'd be like, but I have got a dad. And, you know, would say, like my granddad. Now, the other thing that they knew as well that I didn't was that my granddad was Jewish. And that was also a secret because it wasn't okay in this place. And they'd say things to me like, you know, if you, and they said, this was normal, this stuff was normal, so sort of growing up in Liverpool in the 50s and 60s, it was very sort of sectarian, so there were Catholics and Protestants and Liverpool supporters and Everton supporters and, you know, there was always a reason for someone not to be okay. But for me, it was like not having a dad and then having a granddad who was Jewish. And I remember one day some kids saying to me, you know, if you'd lived in the war, you'd have been, Hitler would have killed you. And the point is that I didn't know what any of these things meant. And I'd go to my grandmother and I'd say, but they're saying this, but they're saying that. And she'd sort of say, she'd say, take no notice of them, but she wouldn't tell me the truth, but she'd go off and talk to their mothers, and I always knew that there was something going on. So it was just, it was never all right to be me, and it was only coming to these rooms and learning that it was all right to show up, it was all right to speak. And, you know, the first time I ever said, my name's Sue, I'm an addict, that just felt so wonderful. I mean, the courage it took to take that, because it took me about nearly 2 years to be able to say, my name's Sue, I'm an addict. Because I certainly couldn't say it during those 18 months when I was still on the methadone script going to meetings. And then when I first got clean, it took me a couple of months after that to be able to say it. Because it felt such... It felt such a stretch for me to be able to say that. And, you know, I'd come to these meetings on my first day clean. First day after, you know, I'd finished my methadone on the Saturday. Sunday, first day clean, was June the 5th, 1988. And I went to Blackfriars meeting. I mean, that meeting doesn't exist anymore. But in those days, that was like, you know, it was Sunday night. I mean, how spiritual was that, going to a meeting on Sunday night? It was my first day clean. And there seemed to be all these guys there, all these very serious sort of... They all seemed to be wearing black polo neck jumpers. And they were like the NA sort of police or the NA sort of spies or NA sort of committee. And that was, you know, I remember this... I went there regularly for a while, but this first meeting, this first night, my first night clean, I mean, I sat there. I couldn't open my mouth. I couldn't stand up. You know, I remember I had a carton of Ribena. I couldn't drink this Ribena in case the straw made those sort of farting noises. Afterwards, because I was with the person who 12-stepped me, and afterwards we went for coffee, and all these people went for coffee, and I just sat there. And I don't think anyone even knew that it was my first day clean, because there was no way I could have stood up for a white key ring. I think I'd got a white key ring sort of 18 months before when I turned up to a meeting using. But once I'd actually put down the drugs, it took a while to get that courage to actually say, this is me, this is who I am. And, you know, I followed the suggestions. And I think, you know, I started off by saying that I have to complicate things. But really, this, you know, getting clean, staying clean, working the program, it's a very simple process. And that's why I sort of sat here at the beginning thinking, how can I talk for 40 minutes about doing this? Because, you know, one of my big things is pride. I think pride and maybe it's laziness or, no, it's you know, I like a diversion. I don't like diversion, that's not the word, is it? And I like things to be different. I don't like to do the same thing twice. Yeah. So I can never plan a chair or whatever. But this makes it really difficult for me because, you know, I've spent a long time in recovery studying. I can't tell you how many sort of things how many courses I've studied in recovery, how many degrees I've taken, how much, which is, I mean, that is such a privilege because, you know, growing up, I really thought I was stupid despite passing my 11 plus and going to that school. You know, after that, I had years of evidence that I wasn't good enough, and recovery has given me the ability to be able to achieve what I've wanted to achieve. But the fact is that I still don't think I'm good enough. I still don't think I can do it, whatever it is. But I've learnt that the most important thing is showing up, following the suggestions. And that works. You know, I've learnt that it works staying clean. It works. It works if you work it. Showing up, following the suggestions. But that also works in other areas of my life. That works in work and that works in studying. And I've just had this experience this summer where I was studying and I'd been really sort of stretched with the work I'm doing and things that are happening in my life. And I had exams this summer and I really thought I'd fail my exams because the reason I'm saying this is that if you ask me, how did you do it or can you do it, I'll say no. But what I've learned in recovery is that as long as I turn up every day and follow the suggestions. And basically, that's what I did in my studying. I turned up every day. I turned up for lectures. I did what I needed to do. And I did okay. But my head told me that I hadn't passed, that I'd failed. And that's, I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what I've learned in recovery, that I don't listen to my head. I don't listen to that negative self-talk, that I turn up and follow the suggestions. And doing that, I can't go wrong. And it's such a privilege to be here. And it's such a privilege to be able to sit here and say that, you know, that I am clean today. And it's thanks to this fellowship and it's thanks to you people. And I leave it there. Thanks, Ruth.